Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Better Embedded Software Testing Through Static Analysis. My name is John McHale, Executive Vice President with Open Systems Media and moderator for today's event. Our speaker today is Matt Rhodes, Senior Application Engineer with MathWorks. In his position, Matt assists customers in the adoption of Polyspace for safer, higher quality embedded software. He leverages his experience not only with other customers and processes, but also with his systems engineering and software development experience from Lockheed Martin, including experience with safety critical train control software. Matt holds a BS and an MS in computer engineering from the University of Central Florida. So before we get started, I have some short housekeeping announcements. The eCast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. I also want to point out some important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. You can also use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them if you need to view them larger. The next important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. The last button on your console window I want to point out allows you to enter questions in real time. And we'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. And now I'm pleased to turn over the mic to Matt Rhodes. Matt?
Thank you, John. So, I'm Matt Rhodes, an application engineer at the MathWorks, and I specialize in software verification for critical and embedded systems. Since I will be referencing several certification standards today, as John already mentioned, my prior experience stems from working with safety critical rail systems, in addition to all of the customers and the knowledge of the MathWorks itself built into that. So today, our focus will be on better software testing. In particular, I'm going to show you how a pair of static analysis tools called Polyspace Bug Finder and Polyspace Code Prover are going to help you be smarter about how you test. Let's see. There we go. Got to be on the first slide. So we'll talk about leveraging these tools to make sure your testing efforts aren't wasted on bad tests. And two, how you can leverage Polyspace Code Prover to achieve more robust, reliable code. And if applied methodically, you can better anticipate software integration issues. Of course, you can always try to make your code more robust with more testing. So, most people already know that exhaustive testing is not a realistic goal. So let's just, you know, look at this a little closer for a second, though. Consider a function called SimpleFunk. This function has 64 bits of input, which means 2 to the 64 tests to run, or 18 quintillion possibilities. That's an 18 followed by 18 digits. Big number. If testing is done with an optimistic 1 microsecond per test, 570,000 yards approximately before you can finish your testing. Obviously, that's not realistic. And it's important to note, that's just for one function. Let me be clear. Even if you could test the black box with all 18 quintillion possible inputs in just one afternoon, you'd still have to confirm that for each test input, that you're getting the expected correct output. And given the vast number of tests that could be performed, that's only a negligible portion of the entire system's entire operating space that can be tested. It's barely even a surface scratch. As Dijkstra put it, to beat this problem, you have to take the structure of the mechanism into account. In other words, understand what's in the box and how it works. And to do this, every good systems engineer and software engineer working with them in harmony, they're going to take the time to understand the requirements and work with the requirements. So Dijkstra is not the only smart person providing this guidance. If your system has to meet any of the safety certification standards out there, you'll quickly appreciate the need to design with verification in mind. Standards for avionics, automotive, medical devices, to name a few, all mandate that functional requirements are verified with testing. For example, ISO 26262 provides a very rigorous guidance. In fact, it provides a strong emphasis on functional safety verification, starting with system concept and persisting throughout the entire software lifecycle, not just, you know, any one part of it. It's on a repeat basis as you go. MathWorks as an organization has a significant experience with all of these standards. And even if you don't have to go through certification, the standards themselves provide some useful verification guidance that starts at project conception. So definitely, whether or not you have to go through these, definitely please do reach out for us for some help. We can provide a lot of guidance that can be helpful. In other words, smarter testing requires us to consider verification from the very start. So you're probably familiar with the V model for verification and validation. And the smarter testing, you know, really starts during the validation activities. So up at the validation activities, the verification, early and often for this verification cannot be stressed enough. There are many techniques to help with this, each of which can also guide verification activities. In particular, MathWorks provides tools like MATLAB and Simulink, and these tools can can aid in validation activities, including prototyping, simulation, and data analysis, to name a few. Results of the validation you perform with these tools can directly feed later verification activities. In fact, it's very common to leverage prototyping to understand how testing will be done. Simulations can be used as verification truths. Data analysis can be used to confirm that a system has passed or failed tests. And no matter how you choose to test, though, you do need to make sure you're validating that you're testing the right thing in the first place. And there are many ways to make sure you're testing the right thing. And static analysis, although predominantly used for verification, is a very useful tool for aiding in this process. In this demo, we're going to focus on two static analysis tools, Polyspace Bug Finder and Polyspace Code Prover. Code Prover is a state-of-the-art tool which provides a formal methods approach. In fact, the formal methods approach to getting a mathematical proof of your code. Bug Finder is a faster static analysis tool that can find a very large array of code defects, but it doesn't have the proof. They work really well together. And between these two tools, we will perform several types of static analysis, including code metrics, heuristic analysis, proof, coding rules, control and data flow, proof. Underline that one again. It's a really good one. So at its simplest level, it's good practice to map the test cases to the requirements they're going to verify. It goes back to the mechanism in the box. With this process, you know you're going to test what's required to be in your system. You have to do this. If you're doing the standards, it's not an option. It's also a way of testing based upon, sorry, I said that right. It is about how you understand what's inside the box. So this here, what you see, is an example of a homegrown unit test system. It references the requirements mapped to each test performed. You can see down the left-hand side with each case. And whether or not you use a homegrown test system, something commercial, or something open source, it's always smart to write the unit test while the code is fresh. The developer in particular who wrote the code will have a vested interest and writing tests to go with that code as you go. Some people prefer to write the tests first and then write the code to pass tests after the tests have been going through. Today, test-driven development is the name given to this practice. That is to say, developing tests against requirements ahead of implementing the behaviors, TDD for short. These are a couple of tests written using an open source testing framework with requirements mapped to the tests. Many of you might know TDD as it was referenced by Kent Beck in the Agile Manifesto. With this quote here by Kent Beck, it's worth pointing out that TDD is much older than the Agile Manifesto itself, and that's just because it makes sense that it's there in the first place at all. The original description of TDD was an ancient book about programming. Manually type in the output tape you expect and program the actual output tape matches the expected output. When describing TDD to older programmers, I often hear, of course, how else could you program? It's that obvious. Of course, we know that's not enough. For starters, we should also heed Dijkstra's advice to take the structure of the mechanism into account. So for those of you who already know test-driven development, you don't have to raise your hands. I can't see. It's fine. But from the Agile world, if you do Agile development, you probably know it already or have heard of it at least. You can appreciate its value, though. Depending on what else you've seen, you probably might also have heard of something called doneness criteria. This is also known as the definition of done, or more simply put, the checklist you have to complete as part of each sprint or increment of your development process. For those of you in the medical device community, this is something to take note of here. The AAMI TIR45, written in 2012, is an important consensus standard, which FDA consensus standard is something special. If you're part of doing this, you'll understand. But it's an important consensus standard that legitimizes agile workflows for safety-critical medical devices. Most importantly, it underlines the importance of doneness criteria to make this work. In other words, the doneness criteria is going to be the pivotal and most critical thing to keep everything in line to make sure you're doing the right job. And it's a good guidance to help you along the way. So to provide a more complete picture, let's build up an example checklist that can be used to verify complete unit testing. The first item is about traceability of requirements. It's a very important item. However, it's a little outside of the scope of this demonstration. We'll pretend it's already been done, and we'll go ahead and check the box. Next, eliminating compiler warnings. It's a very good practice to follow from the start of your development process. And for the sake of this demonstration, you'll see that I don't have compiler warnings on the following screens, but we'll just also assume we've done that as we go along and that it's getting checked off as well. And the next item, which we'll go look at, is it's all about making sure your tests are passing the criteria you've given to them based upon your requirements. Fairly straightforward. I'll give you an example anyway. So here you see some dynamic tests being run. Obviously, we don't have paper tape outputs or nothing else to match against, explicitly in the old form it was. But you can still run our test cases prior to implementation. And as you see here, some of these test cases are passing already. And then you see below that we have a fail status here. And that's because this is a test case that's been written, but there's no implementation yet for the function that's being tested. So it's going to fail, of course, because it's going to not have the right outputs. And in the spirit of early and often verification, a good developer is not going to wait for the testing to be over. It's always good to do this as you go because it's actually going to help you write your tests. It's extremely useful to use. So this doneness criteria verification happens frequently, early and often, in your process. Of course, with a formal agile process or any other kind of variation in testing like this, you'll wind up with a a set checkpoint for when you go and check the list with your group, as you'll see. So for this sprint or increment, there were only three test sets defined. And now you see with the implementation written for this one, it's getting a pass status. It's good to make sure that you're doing this constantly and checking these things for regression. And before we move on, though, I'm going to ask you one thing. How do you know the tests are actually written correctly? Can you trust it yet? So just because we've checked the first two checkboxes doesn't mean we're going to keep them checked. I will for this presentation, of course, but I always urge you to go back and use them as, you know, as part of your daily activities to make sure things are still passing as you go. It's quick and easy to do with modern regression techniques. So FACTS is also another great opportunity for a Dijkstra quote. Program testing can be used to show the presence of bugs, but never to show their absence. This magnificent quote applies to the next four items on our Dungeness criteria checklist. We'll start with Bug Finder in order to get a broad spectrum of static analysis all at once. So the next criteria is all about the Bug Finder. And to do this, we're going to take a single pass at the unit under test. And I'll show you what that looks like. So I've shown you running tests from a make file at the console. Many people find that integrated development environments, or IDEs, make their coding experience much smoother. Conveniently, you can run Polyspace in many ways. Here you see a very popular IDE, Eclipse. And with this IDE, Polyspace is a plugin which allows you to select just the files you want to analyze. As you can see here, we're only running Bug Finder on the unit under test at first. Let's go look at the results. So still in Eclipse, this window here, is I made it larger so you can see the whole list. There are a fair number of results for bug finding, coding rules, and metrics. And we're going to stay in Eclipse for convenience now. So if you want to look, you can open up the results in Bug Finder's own interface, and there's a dashboard overview there that's handy to look at. Let's look at that really quick, and we'll come back. So there are several graphs on the dashboard, including a couple off the top of the screen that indicate the completeness of the analysis. But now we're just going to focus on the defects and the MISRA violations. In case you aren't familiar with MISRA, that's an acronym for Motor Industry Software Reliability Association, as you can see just above the purple lines spelled out. Their coding rule sets are very widely used throughout the software industry. And I'll leave it at that. They're very widely used. Here, you see that most of our violations are of Rule 2.7. We also have three categories of defects found by Bug Finder that are not coding rule violations. All right. It's important that we keep the current focus of our workflow in mind, though. And when considering these results, we need to understand the kinds of things we're actually going to care about looking for. Let me show you what I mean by that. So looking back at the result summary, I'll point out that several of these categories shouldn't matter at this point in the scope of analysis. So in particular, unused parameters and functions that are present because the architecture has been laid out already and we've mapped them out ahead of time, they're there, but they're not implemented yet. They're just the framework that you have for generation. It's present for you. And, of course, you're going to get violations because of those kind of things. We don't care about those right now. There's both defect violations for that and MISRA rules following that, including Rule 2.7 that I mentioned. Really no point in worrying about at this point for the unit test scope. For the metrics, we're only going to care about threshold violations. Now, you see here the actual numbers for the metrics we have. What you're going to see momentarily is that we're only going to see metrics if they violate thresholds we've set. All right? In fact, you probably won't see any because I didn't violate any in this particular demo, but you'll see. We can use a custom unit test review scope, though, to help us And that's going to define everything we want to look at for what we're doing at unit testing. So you'll notice I've still in Eclipse. I've shrunk the results list back down, and it's a much shorter list all of a sudden, and that's because the unit test C review scope has been selected now. And that's right there at the top of the result summary window. Let's look closer at the results that we have, though. So we're on the first result, and I've resized the results details window. In addition to the straightforward description that it gets you, clicking on the question mark here is going to provide some useful context-sensitive help. This provides more background on the particular issue you're looking at, and it's especially useful in case you just need a better understanding of what's going on. It's not obvious necessarily all the time. Some of the MISR rules are, can be very cryptic, and so it's helpful to have this help as you go. In some cases, some of the examples provided can help you understand how to fix the issues too. Now, in this case, you're going to notice that the results review has a set of comments in it that have already been populated. And what you're going to see is that due to the comment put into the code at development time, because we anticipated this issue being coming up based upon what was happening here, Polyspace automatically reads that and populates the results review status for you. For comments where it hasn't been done yet, you can write right in the box, as you'll see. For now, we'll move on to the next thing. We'll move on to the coding rule violation because the second defect has the same comment effectively. So this issue is pretty straightforward. Rotate returns a value, and I'm not assigning it to anything. I don't think I need to do anything with the return value in this case, but I'd better not let arrogance get the best of me. So I'll comment it in the results, and then we'll review that with the team later. All right. A short note in the box should do it, and if I need to change the code later, I will. If I'm right, though, this violation will get justified in the future. And in fact, the future's now. Let's pretend the team agreed, the case was okay, and we can go back and check our box. So the next criteria is to use CodeProver to verify the absence of proven errors. We'll look at CodeProver results on both the unit under test and the unit test harness running the unit test on the unit under test. Sorry for the mouthful. We'll start with the test harness and unit under test. And as you can see from the file selection, the unit utilities.c and the utilities test.c are the two things we're analyzing now. So it's going to be a constrained version of the analysis because of the main provided in the test harness. So getting to the results, this is the dashboard view of the results. The most important thing we see here is green. That's saying the code is proven free from all runtime errors. All right. There are also some coding rule violations, but many of them are going to go away with our review scope. And also, since we now have the test harness included, there are some new violations we've not seen before. But really, it's all about the green here. The green is fantastic. We know we don't have code errors in our tests. Let me repeat that. We know now that we don't have code errors in our test, right? You might still have incorrect requirements or things of that nature, so you still have to do other things. But the proof here is saying that you have not coded this incorrectly from a build point of view, the semantic correctness. So now that we see this, let's go ahead and we'll move on. In fact, you already know how to fix the coding rules from what I've shown you already, so we'll skip that. But just because the code's all green with the test harness doesn't mean there aren't issues the test harness has not considered yet. So this is the dashboard review of the results. Sorry, no, it's not. Wrong slide. So using our unit test C scope again, back on the results for the Code Prover now. There's only one thing we haven't seen before, and that's this orange overflow. In fact, before we talk about this any more in depth, let's jump ahead to our Dennis criteria checklist. This orange is a very interesting result. It's a potential error that we need to address. Okay. So now, looking back at the Code Prover specific items in our checklist, there's all three of them are up now. And we're going to see that Code Prover is going to help us with all three of these very critical items. And proving the absence of errors in the code, as previously mentioned with Green, is going to be very key. In some cases, if there is a failure in the code, every time you get to that point in the code, no matter how you get to that point in the code, we're going to use red for that. That's a systematic error. Just take care of those right away. You shouldn't see them often once you get into the swing of things. It's more about just simple overlooks that are easy to correct. It's really all about the orange and the gray and the green. And so the next thing is the gray code or dead code. More specifically, that's the code that's logically unreachable. It will be colored gray. These three colors are probably the most important, but orange gets the most emphasis because it's the most interesting to the design process. It's really, you want to take advantage of seeing the orange earlier in your process and often because it's going to help you with lots of guidance as you're about to see. It's about potential errors like the overflow we just saw. Let's look at it closer, actually. So, always go back to the yellow box for results details. And so reading this, we see that the orange finding is that there's a potential overflow. And Polyspace is suggesting that we might want to apply something called DRS. That stands for Data Range Specification. It's how Polyspace is directed to make assumptions such as what can get passed to a parameter, right? It's actually an extremely useful mechanism to anticipate problems due to integration. So in other words, if this can be called with something that could cause an overflow, you now have a chance to think about how you're going to handle it. All right? But before, and we can go in and say that, well, this may only get past values of 0 to 100, so it should never overflow on us. That being said, it's not always the best assumption to make right away. We should understand what's happening in more detail before we make an assumption like that and use that to guide some choices that are really about the design of your system. So we're going to use the Polyspace's Code Prover's own interface at this point instead of Eclipse to explore the issue more in depth. Clicking this button here will open the results we're seeing now in Polyspace's own advanced interface. So the first window, can't trust enough. Always look at the results details first. It's also available in Eclipse, as you saw. And for every Polyspace result you need to explore, this is where you're going. That yellow box is going to give you the most pertinent information, as we've already shown you. You'll notice that there is an event trace in the bottom of the window in this case. And you can click on each event to explore the probable cause trace for this event, for this issue. There's some other ways we can explore the issue, too. Let's look at some of those. So here, we have got a snippet of just the source code itself. And you'll notice that there's Polyspace provides some very useful highlighting. In addition to the four colors on the code itself that depict proof and vulnerability, these tooltips provide extremely useful information. In addition to the variable ranges and details about implicit upcasting that you're seeing, they're also, in this case, pointing out that there's a probable cause for the subtraction that the parameter desired tick is unconstrained when it's assigned to CMD POS. And we have a couple of options to address this. We can add some explicit saturation code to the function parameter with the DRS that I just showed you. Oh, sorry. You can do that in the code itself. Or you can simulate the integration of the function into the rest of your system by using that data range specification with an assumed range constraint. And that's more about anticipating what could happen. And in fact, let's look at what that interface looks like. So constraint specification allows you to provide integration assumptions, as I've already said, specifically for global variables, for user-defined functions, and for sub-functions. Yes, you can even simulate the outputs from your code you haven't written yet. That's what sub-functions are all about. So let's apply some constraints to the input on the sweep function. So you're going to find the function in the list that you're looking to affect and provide assumptions for, and then you're going to fill out the range we want to use for our proof. So here you see that I have the range of 0 to 3,042. We can do better than this, though. I'm not actually going to use this right now. Even if our assumption is right in this case, we should probably suggest a requirement to saturate the command input because we really want to avoid actuator damage to the system. So let's go ahead and add some actual saturation code to our implementation and then rerun CodeProver. So here, if you look in the top source code window back in Eclipse, you'll see that we've added the saturation code there on line 53. And I'm also running, I ran it again with the utilities .c, this is again a robustness view of the code. So not having any test cases written. We're actually using the main generator to do this. With the new results up, we see the overflow has disappeared and our saturation worked well. We do have some new results though. I'm gonna show you another trick for that. This button right here is a filter for just looking at new results. So after you click on this, you'll see only new findings since the last run. So we've gone from three findings to two findings now. And we'll look at the miser later. We're going to focus on the dead code for now, because that's actually the next item on our checklist, was the dead code. So as you can see from the results details, the dead code is talking about this starting at line 66 here. You can actually see that we already have an attempt to protect the actuator with that max range ticks on POS error. And now that we've added saturation code to protect this calculation of POS error, the if condition protecting the call to rotate is no longer needed. So let's just get rid of that condition and run CodeProver again and we'll see we have some more robust code now. So with a refresh analysis after that code change, we actually don't see any more results in our unit test scope. There was a miser error before. I went ahead and fixed it. It was the saturation code I wrote on line up above line 53, or around line 53, actually had a lack of a missing default else statement required by MISRA. And so you can see that on line 62, I've added this default statement in. So also to make sure I didn't forget anything else, I did turn off the new results filter just to make sure there wasn't anything old that I'd forgotten. All right, so you see that unit test scope, there's nothing left in that box to check. So I guess at this point, we just need to make sure we double-check the dashboard for completeness. And we see the code is in fact all green. So we have 100% coverage of our code analysis. And the only coding rule defects left are the ones that are out of scope for what we care about right now. All right. We better make sure our test cases are still passing though. So let's do that next. And indeed, if you look, they're all still passing. So nothing was broken in this process. And you can quickly see how this builds up and the iteration becomes much more powerful. So now that we've addressed all these next three items, actually, we see that all the results are green or justified. Let's go ahead and check those boxes. The next item is about peer review. Every good process has some peer review in it. I hope this is something that you're doing already. If not, I really encourage you to do this. And as you've seen from some of the results comments we've used, Polyspace can help with this also. Assuming all goes well in the review, we'll check this box also. Let's just go ahead and assume that's the case for the purpose of this demo, and we'll move on to the next thing. To conclusion. Why don't we go ahead and review the doneness criteria for this presentation itself? So I showed you how to use Bug Finder and CodeProver in sequence, both on your test code and your implementation code. This helps make sure your test efforts aren't wasted on bad tests. So check. I showed you the impact of running CodeProver for robustness on a single unit. You saw how we can make sure that this code made the code more robust. So check. And you also saw how I could have used this test assumptions ahead of integration. And if applied methodically, you can actually better anticipate software integration issues before your choices are limited. Very helpful. And as a bonus, there are, this presentation, you can download in PDF form. You can use that checklist yourself. It's a useful piece to use on your own. If you need to provide test coverage, for instance, you can add some check steps for that. You'll want to tailor this to your own needs, but it's a really good starting point to use for your own development. Right? In fact, if you do add coverage, I'd probably put it right after the CodeProver checks. If you have dead code, there's no point trying to get coverage if you can't get to it and you can prove you can't get to it. Right? So reach out to us, learn more, and there's a lot more you can find out about everything from this list here. We're going to head and do some Q&A now. And so I'll let John get back on to moderate the questions for me. And we'll start going with what you have.
Excellent. Thank you, Matt. That was an excellent presentation.
Thank
really
you.
Good job. So why don't we go to the questions and talk a little bit. First question from the audience we have here. You mentioned, we'll start with an earlier one, actually. What languages does Polyspace support?
So good question. Polyspace works for C, C++, and Ada code. And actually, conveniently, I see another question related to it. Model-based design, if you're generating code, we actually have some integration right into Simulink for that process also.
Which question were you referring to, Matt? What number there? You said you saw another question.
Oh, yeah, that looked like
just tell me the number.
8.
Okay, got it. I want to make sure I don't ask it of you again. Next question. What compilers does Polyspace support?
Polyspace is compiler agnostic. As long as your compiler is going to work with the languages we spoke about, C, C++, or Ada, we will we'll be able to handle it. And so we tend to prefer ANSI or ISO compliant code, or for Ada, LRM compliant code. But in short, if it works with that, we have some interesting mechanisms to cope with all the aberrations of the language as well.
Thanks, Matt. And to the audience, keep your questions coming in. You got Matt for about another 15 to 20 minutes to ask him anything you like. Next question. Matt, how well does Polyspace work on larger projects with more integrated code?
That's a great question, actually. So I showed you today Polyspace only at unit test level, only because it's. I can't stress enough how important it is to run at that level. However, it works all the way up to your entire code base also. It's a very useful process to have, and it provides a lot of artifacts for any certification you need to do. Using it earlier in the process, if you can. I understand a lot of people have code that's already there that you have to go through as well, and that's fine. We'll handle it just fine. It's not a big deal. It is easier, though, if you start from the beginning, and or if you have an existing code base, you can baseline it, and we should probably talk about what that means if you work with us. We can talk more about baselining and what that means
with
a tool like CodeProver and Bug Finder. But the important thing is to know that it will work with that, and then any new development you add on top of that, you can use this process for a very useful effect.
Did you want to go into baselining more, though? You said you'd like to.
Let's leave that for a one-on-one because it's going to vary for every customer. Everybody
who
uses the tool is a little bit different based upon the process. So that's a good one to do separately.
Excellent. Okay. Next question. Does Polyspace support other IDEs besides Eclipse?
Yeah. So we have support for Eclipse and Visual Studio. We also support integration, as I already mentioned, with the Simulink MATLAB environment. And beyond that, we don't have any additional support built in. However, because you can run Polyspace from the command line, and we provide a very nice interface for that, it's actually very easy to plumb many other IDEs with ways to run Polyspace from your IDEs using the command line interface that we have.
Okay. Got another question here from the audience. Matt, can custom rules be added?
Yes, they can. That said, I always encourage you to look at what it is that you need rules for in the first place, because typically the rule sets that are already there between MISRA and JSF, et cetera, they typically have everything covered for what you need. The custom rules that we have are really more about the naming conventions, and we have a nice interface for that, too. We can show you if you want to reach out to us later.
Okay. Next question. Is there support for any continuous integration servers?
Continuous. Oh, right. So you're talking about things like Bamboo and Jenkins and that kind of thing. So right now we don't have any new out-of-the-box plugins for that, but we do have on our MATLAB file exchange, you can go there and search for Polyspace, and we have some application engineers who have written a Jenkins plugin. And again, the command line interface that you have access to with Polyspace does allow you to do integration yourself pretty easily with that process. But otherwise, no, we don't have any out-of-the-box plugins other than what our AE in Germany has provided for Jenkins.
Okay. Next question from the audience. What host operating systems are supported, Windows, Linux, Mac OS?
Yes, all three of those.
Is there anything unique with any of those operating systems that maybe you'd want to share or that maybe the audience should look out for? Or is it pretty much a standard application, regardless of operating system?
It's for Polyspace, pretty much regardless of the operating system. It works well on Windows, Linux, and Mac. Obviously, each one has some of their own caveats based upon the OS itself, but they're really not a big deal. Depending on if you're a Linux user, you're probably going to be on the command line most of the time anyway, and you might even be like me, who in like VI. Or Vim, or some of my colleagues who prefer Emacs, and there's some, I've seen some nice people, some things people have done to actually integrate Polyspace with those editors to do some cool stuff there and launch Polyspace for results viewing.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Next question from the audience. Can Polyspace provide results directly to any bug tracking systems? Right now we use Bugzilla, but we might be willing to switch with a tool like this.
So unfortunately the answer to that is no. We don't have any integration with bug tracking systems at the moment. It's a simple answer, no for that one. It's not hard to use Comet, but there's no direct imports.
Okay.
And actually, that said, it's important to note that I'd want to ask you why you want to do that too, because typically before you just import issues into a system, you probably want to understand why it's an issue first, and so that process oftentimes will have you wanting to do it manually anyway.
Matt, you know, based on what you just said, is that often that you have customers who have not kind of thought through what their issue was, and what's some of the common criteria you see, or common mistakes people made, or things that you hear from different customers that kind of can be solved by Polyspace? Is there one that stands out among the others?
Wow, that's a really broad question, actually. So I would say that the Code Preview is going to focus on runtime errors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're using it, you are going to be at a stage, ideally, where you're going to go and understand the problems you're working with. And typically, if you're doing it early during this unit test phase anyway, it doesn't ever make it into the bug tracking system because the developers are using it as a tool more efficiently to get what they need as they go. The bug finder adds a lot of things to what it can search for that are not provable items. And because of that, you're going to see that it's good at finding probable bugs, things that oftentimes a developer might just consider, oh, that's a typo, I didn't mean to do that. And it'll be kind of like a spell checker as you go. It makes life a lot easier to deal with those things earlier in the process. So from that point of view, if you're using it earlier, like the customers that do use it for the unit test level, whether you're doing test-driven development or not, doing it early is going to actually eliminate a lot of the need for even integrating to a bug system anyway.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. Keep those questions coming. We've got a lot more time here with Matt, and he can answer anything you might have. So our next question, do I have to use Eclipse? What if I wanted to use this from the command line instead?
So, yeah, I think kind of answered that one already, but so you can use it from the command line. You can use it from other IDEs besides Eclipse if you plumb them yourself. We have a plugin for Visual Studio. We have integration with Simulink and MATLAB. In fact, if you are generating code with Embedded Coder, which is very popular in several industries, including the automotive and aerospace, then what you'll see is that you can actually find a code error, and there's a link back to the model you can click on, so you can actually use that information to go back and correct your model. A very useful process there. But otherwise, from the command line, you can do all kinds of stuff with the command line. In fact, I typically treat the interface for configuration of the project as a training wheels for the system, if you will. So it's a good way to understand how the system works, but ultimately on your steady state operation, if you will, it'll be most people go to a command line driven or even plumbing it into their make files or other build systems that way. And at the unit test level, you can do that too, because you get a do this for regression. So you might choose to do some regression testing with your unit tests at that level to make your life easier.
Thanks, Matt. And to the audience, once again, keep those questions coming in. We have a question here. It always comes down to price. How much do your tools cost, Matt?
So I'm actually not a salesperson, so I'm not really the one to answer that question. Definitely reach out to us, and that's something that we can, it depends on, there's many configurations for how you use this and how, it's based upon the size of your team to determine how you want to set up, and then based upon that setup you choose, it's pretty straightforward pricing. But the account representative you'd work with, they would be able to give you some more specific answers as you go.
And Matt, if our audience doesn't have an account representative, is there a place on the website you can direct them?
Good question. So if you go to our website, you can request a trial, of course, and that'll take you through the process. You can also call our main line to talk to a salesperson. I believe the number is 508-647-7000. And I believe the sales line is the first option, but there's a phone tree right there, and it'll tell you what you need to do. But Also, the other name, so in the United States, and, you know, we have an account rep who focuses just on Polyspace. His name is Damian Packer. If you are overseas anywhere, we have various account reps around in Germany and elsewhere. And so if you do call the office, they'll get you to the appropriate person.
Thanks, Matt. I have a question based on one of your earlier slides, slide six, I think it was, where you talk about how, you know, safety standard certifications, they all, you know, following standards is important. And it's also part of your background when you were with Lockheed Martin on rail certification. Is there anything unique from standard to standard or actual industry, like in avionics, you have DO-178C, and then you have your rail standards. Is there anything different that you're, different issues like you see with each set, or is it pretty much similar problems across the board?
How to answer that? That's kind of a yes and no. So at the core of it, in terms of actual software, it gets down to the same concepts no matter what industry you're in. You have to make sure that, you know, you're using a computer, embedded computer typically, and if you are, the processors work in defined ways and compilers have defined ways for building things up, but there's also undefined behavior, so such as divide by zero and overflow and that kind of thing. Sometimes that's target specific, sometimes it's not defined at all. It depends, and really, no matter what industry you're in, it really comes down to making sure that you have written the code with semantic correctness in mind, not just the functional correctness, you know, the behavioral needs that you have. In fact, a lot of people don't realize, you know, they go through and get all their tests working just fine, and, you know, it used to be people did unit testing naturally all the time, as you saw from the Kent Beck quote. But nowadays, a lot of times it's very popular, budgets are getting tight or schedules getting tight, and people like to take shortcuts, so they'll actually skip things like unit tests. And unfortunately, no matter what industry you're in, I've seen that has a knock-on effect. It's just not pleasant when you get to going to integration and other things around there. It's a lot easier to deal with things if you've understood it at the unit level. And to that end, so like aerospace industry, if you think about how they build airplanes, the bolts that they use are all rated for certain stresses. And so they know ahead of time from their engineering process what stresses can be put on the plane. Well, you know, they have bolts they trust based upon the process for how they're designed, and they do testing as well to make sure that they, you know, do statistical analysis of those bolts. You want to do the same thing with your software. You want to take the time to trust the individual components that you're going to build the software with. So, you know, in the DO world, for instance, I hear often that I say unit testing, and a unit so often winds up being a whole bunch of things put together already that really should have been individually unit tested before they put them together. But because it's a subsystem, they're calling that the unit. So, but some of the people who do that understand the value of doing the lower level unit testing. And they actually get some credits from using Polyspace. In fact, I forgot to mention we have some certification kits for our tools, not just Polyspace, but for the embedded coder and Simulink, et cetera, that can be beneficial to your process. Automotive, medical devices, I mean, no matter where you go to apply these tools, it's extremely valuable if you need confidence in your code to be able to prove the absence of errors and leverage information about vulnerabilities, the oranges, in order to guide your design process.
Thanks, Matt. Great answer. A couple questions to go here. Let's put on a time machine here. What do you guys got working on in your R&D, so to speak, when you've evolved Polyspace going forward? What do you see some challenges to overcome? New capabilities.
So if you were to ask our lead developer, he always likes to focus on the fact that we're always making the products faster. So Bug Finder, we actually created Bug Finder a few years ago now, specifically to have a tool that's based upon similar technology but a lot faster. And so it gets used in conjunction with CodeProver. CodeProver at the unit level is still extremely fast, but on the bigger verifications as you grow your system, it does take longer than the bug finder. So, you know, speed is a constant thing. Usability. I spend probably, you know, 10 to 15 hours a week just working with our development team, giving customer feedback, working with our usability experts to improve the tools. So, in fact, if you use the tools with us, I encourage you to send emails to us and say, hey, you know, it'd be really nice if this did work like this, or if I could get, you know, this doing this. This feedback is valuable. We're constantly putting it into the tool. We actually have, MathWorks in general has two releases a year, one in the spring, one in the fall, and we use that to keep our tools constantly improving.
Thanks, Matt. And kind of a last question here. Anywhere folks can go to see your technology demonstrated in person, maybe at an industry event that's coming up that would be of that where Polyspace might be demonstrated? Do you guys have an exhibit?
Ah, okay. Well, so if you're in the automotive industry, you shouldn't be on this webinar now. You should be at an event we have today. And I know we just had ESC Boston. I guess coming up in the future, there's an ESC Minneapolis in September, I believe, that we'll be at. We should be at the Flight Software Workshop in December. But regardless of the events, actually, feel free to reach out to us, and we can do live demonstration for you. We can go more in depth, and you know, your group can get a private audience with us to look at exactly what it is that you want to see, and we can talk about how you may or may not want to use it. Hopefully you do.
Thank you, Matt. That brings us right up to our time limit for today. Sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone may get back to you after this ecast with more information. I want to thank Matt Rhodes for speaking today and MathWorks for sponsoring the event. This ecast will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending. I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media ecast. Goodbye.